Plots pulled from newspaper headlines can certainly provide interesting movie fodder, such as the case with the acclaimed drama Fruitvale Station and the biopic Jobs about the late Apple founder Steve Jobs. But does truth lose out when Hollywood makes the transition from controversial news story to the big screen? When has Hollywood gotten it right, and when has it gotten it wrong? We want to know what you think. We'll take your calls, and we'll review the latest flicks currently showing at your local Cineplex. Join me, Russ Simmons, and my fellow film critics for Central Standard Friday as we head to the theaters. It's all coming up right after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard here on KCUR-FM. My name is Russ Simmons. I'm with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. And since I'm sitting here in the host seat, that means it's movie day here on Central Standard. We're going to be talking about some of the recent films that have popped up on area screens, and we'll be taking your calls as well. And I want to welcome my fellow film critics around the table here who include...
This is Loie Lockerbie. I freelance for the Kansas City Star and KC Active and have a blog at suchacritic.com.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
And there are a number of movies that have opened up over the last month or so that deal with contemporary events or relatively recent history. So we thought it might be interesting to get your feedback as well. We'd like to know, what are some of your favorite adaptations of actual events that played back on the big screen? How about the ones that were good, the ones that worked, and the ones that failed? You can always give us a call. The number here is 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCURCST, or you can always email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We want to get your feedback, not only on the films that deal with contemporary history, but also all of the movies that have opened up over the last month or so that we'll be covering. And since that is the topic of the day, let's go ahead and start with one that deals with a sweeping overview of the civil rights movement as seen through the eyes of a single man, a butler, who worked in seven administrations in the White House, and it's called Lee Daniels, the Butler.
Well, I know it's not an earth-shaking topic in this wise, but why is it Lee Daniels, the Butler? Now,
yeah.
Something about a 1910 or 19-teen film called The Butler, so what? Mm-hmm. There's no legal problem there. That
apparently.
I know of. Well, somebody, I don't buy it for a minute. Why is Lee Daniels' name on the title? I frankly resent that. Now, he's a black man. He's sympathetic with the subjects. But I don't like a director's name usurping the title of the film, even though he made it, of course. But
he's not the first.
Well, talk to Warner Brothers and whoever filed this stupid lawsuit.
I'm sure Lee Daniels is rejoicing. Yeah. Anyway, notwithstanding, it's an okay movie. The worst batch of lookalike actors I think I've ever seen in a movie, especially Robin Williams as President Eisenhower. We can go on down the list if you want. I'll leave that to you guys. But that really jarred with me, those really flimsy attempts to create a lookalike atmosphere. Now, Oprah and Forrest Whitaker, I think, are both fine. Whitaker especially. He very much downplays the role. You know, when you think of him as the warlord in the film of some years ago in Africa, was it Idi Amin?
Last King of Scotland. Idi Amin in Last King of Scotland.
When you think of that, you know what chops this guy has. Well, he keeps it all undercover here, and that's part of the theme of the film, as a matter of fact, because he is a butler indeed at the White House through several presidencies from Robin Williams, on up through Reagan. It's hard to make a film that you survey history because it's like, okay, here's the Woolworth
lunch
counter sit-in. You know, here are the Freedom Riders. Here's the Black Panthers. Here's the assassination. Here's the civil rights. It's like you check them off on a checklist and you give short shrift to each one of them. And at the same time, you've got Tower Butler in the White House doing his thing, not being a part of the room as it's told him to be absent when you're there, totally subservient to the job. I liked the film in the sense that once in a while you'll get a cross-cutting montage, which is very potent. For example, at the lunch counter sit-in, you're cross-cutting back and forth to Forrest Whitaker and his buddies serving a dinner at the White House. Cut back and forth. The violence of the one, the repressed atmosphere of the other. It's quite a striking contrast. But I just don't care much personally for these overviews of history, and you touch the bases, and it's more pro forma than anything else. Maybe I take away from it, at least we had the tensions between father and son, as the son takes on civil rights issues, whereas the father has learned to keep everything covert. That part of it I liked. Fans of Oprah, I think, will find that she's very understated. She's not playing a character that's pleasant all the time. Out of 4 stars, I'm going to give it 2.5.
Lowy?
Are we 4 stars or 5?
Are we doing 5? 2? Okay. 3.
Okay.
3.
And Lowy?
Yeah, I agree with most of what John said about the way it kind of checks off historic events. And the stunt casting is really distracting.
That's a good term.
Yeah. But although I will give the actors credit for this, they don't ham it up. They try to be very understated, and they try to really give a performance instead of some sort of Saturday Night Live impersonation. So it's not quite as bad as it could have been. But Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey and David Oyelowo, I think is how you say his name, who plays the oldest son, are all just flat out terrific. I had a friend of mine sitting next to me going, I don't know if I'm going to be able to forget that I'm watching Oprah. And I'm like, well, this reminds us of what a good actress she really is. And she's not afraid to be part of an ensemble despite being this huge star. The thing that I really liked about the film, though, and I think elevates it quite a bit, is that it's not just a staid biopic. It really digs into some very provocative questions that have gone on within the civil rights movement from day one of, you know, when do you speak up? How do you speak up? Where do you speak up? Do you speak up at all? You know, the father, Forrest Whitaker's character, believes that if you keep your head down and do what you're supposed to do, then people will come to respect you and things will work out. The son is completely opposed to that. He wants to get out there and push for his rights and eventually, like, physically fight for them. And that debate really permeates the entire film. And I think despite the melodrama and the contrivances and some of the things that are very distracting about it, that part is really well done. And I think it's a good illustration, especially for maybe people who aren't that familiar with the civil rights movement. It's very educational, too, because it really gets into some of these debates and some of the issues that people still face, even today. So I actually liked it a little more, and on a 5-star scale, I think I'd give it a 3.5.
You know, I think I liked it probably a little bit more than both of you. This is a movie that obviously is flawed, and the ones that you've pointed out I would totally agree with. And the plot is really more a series of signposts than it is a real plot. However, the cast is so good that they allow this movie to pack an emotional punch. And I have to admit that I was very affected by the end of this film. And also, there's a really telling moment which kind of sums it all up to my mind. It's when Martin Luther King is sitting in his motel room the night of the assassination, and just so happens that the fictional character who is
Forrest Gumpson,
exactly, that's Forrest Whitaker's son, supposedly, is sitting in there with him, and he says that his dad is a butler. And so Martin Luther King says, oh, so he's a subversive. And his son just never thought of it in that way. He said, here's someone who's showing the white man that I work hard, I'm disciplined, and I do what needs to be done to make things work. And that totally goes against the stereotype that the white people have of us.
Well,
it's
there's
good
that,
for him.
That line from Milton, they also serve who stand and wait.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So this is a movie that I think does tend to slip into stereotypes and cliches. But at the same time, it packs that emotional punch. So I'm going to give it a 4. So between a 3, 3.5, and a 4 for Lee Daniels, the butler, we're going to average that out to 3.5 stars. Yes, John?
One quick note, if I may. I'm wondering about younger audiences, and I certainly hope they come. What will they be thinking during the lunch counter sequence and the Freedom Ride sequence? Are they going to say, oh, that could not have happened. Oh, that's exaggerated. Oh, that's whatever.
Well, maybe they'll have their parents and grandparents there to go, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know.
The topic is adaptations of actual events played out on the big screen. Certainly, there are events that are redepicted here in The Butler. We want to get your feedback, so call us at 816-235-2888 about your favorite adaptations of actual events and what makes the good ones work and the bad ones misses. Just give us a call and let us know. This is a talk show, and so we want to make sure that we hear some talk from you as well. Let's move on to another film that I can't falls into this category as well. It's about a recent event. It's called Fruitvale Station. John?
Well, it's pretty terrific. And Michael B. Jordan is really, really terrific, if that doesn't sound redundant, as Oscar Grant. Now, this is a true story, as you indicated. A young black man is gunned down. Well, yeah, he's gunned down as a result of an altercation in a subway. Takes place, I believe, it's Halloween night. Or is it
New Year's Day?
New Year's, I'm sorry. And there's festivities going on inside, and things kind of get out of hand, and then suddenly you have this confrontation with the police. Controversial case. What this movie does for me is show us a very human young man, flaws and all, who's a very loving father. The scenes with his little girl, four-year-old little girl, are wonderful. And it helps us, I think, understand the real tragedy of the demise of this guy for no apparent reason other than just the chaos of a moment. So it's the characterization, I think, by Michael B. Jordan that really carries today. A lot of people are noticing this. I mean, this is hardly an original insight from me. So I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I like this movie a lot as well. It's very, very disturbing and sad, obviously, because of the subject matter. But it's very honest, and it has a feel of authenticity. We don't know what really happened in the 24 hours leading up to this event, but that's what this film depicts. With the exception of a couple of flashback scenes, it's all 24 hours leading up to this event, which happened early in the morning on New Year's Day when they were out partying because of the holiday. And it also shows this character warts and all. Yeah. Because this is not a perfect human being. However, he is a guy who seemed to be trying to get his life together and try to become a more, a citizen who was more responsible. And so in that respect, I have a lot of respect for this film. And also, I'd also like to point out a terrific performance by Octavia Spencer as his mother, she's already an Oscar winner for The Help. I think she's going to be nominated yet again for this film. And I suspect that Michael B. Jordan will be nominated as well. This is a first film, which is kind of astonishing, given how well I think it's handled. First-time filmmaker, and it was a big hit at Sundance, and it deserved to be. So I'm highly recommending this film as well. So I'm going to give it a 4 for Fruitvale Station, and John and I will agree that it deserves that 4 rating.
And oh yes, fate turns on a dime, because the mother had urged him to take the train, whereas he wanted to drive the car, I believe.
And naturally, she blames herself.
And because he takes the train, yeah. Mm-hmm. Funny, I would think of it as Halloween because it was a Halloween horror that occurs. Really.
Right. Let's talk about another film that has some relatively recent historical impact, and that is Lovelace, the story of porn queen Linda Lovelace, who was back in the 70s, became famous through a porn film called Deep Throat. Loie?
Well, this is another movie that doesn't entirely work, but it's still so interesting that I have to recommend it. The first, I guess, two-thirds of the movie is almost like the early part of Boogie Nights. This young woman is from a very sheltered background. She falls in love. She's played by Amanda Seyfried, who's very good. And she falls in love with this kind of sleazy but very fun and interesting guy named Chuck Traynor. He's played by Peter Sarsgaard. And over time, they get into the porn industry, which is really burgeoning in the mid-70s. And she has a particular talent that leads her to star in the infamous, famous Deep Throat, which becomes the huge hit, and she becomes a big celebrity. Then it shifts gears to 6 years later when she's writing her memoirs, and it flashes back to some of the same incidents and shows a much, much darker side to what's happening. The trainer was very abusive and very controlling, and she was terrified and coerced into doing a lot of this stuff. And eventually found the courage to escape and got help from a couple of unlikely places. And it kind of shows her, they intercut footage of the actress with like real interviews with Phil Donahue and that kind of thing. And you know, it never quite gels because, first of all, you don't really know whose perspective the first part of the film was supposed to be coming from, you know, and then when it shifts to hers, you know, it's a little bit, you feel a little off balance by trying to figure out, okay, where are we here? Certainly, you know, there are people who worked with them on the film and who knew her, who questioned some of the things she said about it. I mean, it's a very complicated story. But as far as kind of setting you up a little bit to see this as this kind of halfway glamorous, you know, fun story, and then shifting into, you know, it's not a story about sexual liberation. It's a story about abuse and exploitation. It really makes you stop and think about what was really going on and what you really see when you see the pictures of this woman, you know, throwing her hands up in the air and smiling. So I would give it a 3.5.
Wow.
For somewhat the same reasons, you know, I think it doesn't entirely work, but it's so interesting and it really makes you stop and look differently at what you've been seeing. And the performances are all first rate.
I would think, though, Lloyd, that the first half or whatever length that is of the film is really the public's point of view.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's how I think people who go to those theaters and see those films, they kind of want it to be like, she's oversexed, she's maybe reluctant, but that's part of the sexiness, she's happy, she goes at things with gusto, it's bright colors, she's very upbeat, and then the shift. Mm-hmm. And it was a shocker to me because I was buying into that, well, that's the story the movie appears to want to tell, and then boom. The clacking of the typewriter keys, and suddenly the tone turns dark. Watch for a tiny moment when we see her in the first part of the film, just reveling in the applause of a screening where she's the guest, and there she is on stage bowing to the audience, and we see a reverse shot from behind her as she very gracefully bows, and with the gown and everything. Well, in the second half of the film, we get a repeat of that shot, only now she's upset. She's tentative. She's disturbed. We see the same moment, the same bow, but it is different.
Hmm.
It's different. It's clumsier. And it's not a convincing show of, I love this celebrity. Those two shots, I think, are mirror images, I guess you'd say, of each other. And really, I think, sum up the whole film. Now, which of those two do we believe? I'm not so sure. Do we really believe the second half? There was a lot of controversy at the time about she's justifying herself and she's blaming everybody but herself and all of that. I never saw the film, believe it or not. I was in the Army at the time, and this was all just reported action in Germany. So, but I don't recall there being a wholesale investment of truth in her memoir either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it really does kind of leave everything hanging as far as, okay, what part of it's true? Is any of it completely true?
Yeah.
You know.
So I'm going to go 3 stars.
3, okay, so let's average that out to a 3 for Lovelace, rated R. I'm curious, John, you were probably, if you were in the Army, perhaps you weren't there at the time, but shortly, at the height of her fame, and shortly after Deep Throat, she made a mainstream movie that she shot in Lawrence, Kansas at the campus of KU. And I know that there were huge crowds that showed up for these scenes where she's talking to the crowds and people are, you know, throwing questions at her and whatever. And I just wonder if there's anyone out there who is a part of that who can tell us about Linda Lovelace. You can also give us a call at 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCURCST. Let us know about your Linda Lovelace experience.
Now, bless her heart, she was not the baby doll cutesiness of Amanda Seyfried.
Mm.
There's no way to put this delicately, but she was not a glamour girl like Seyfried is.
Right.
So there's a difference in how we regard her on this movie as to how she appeared in real life, in the press and in public appearances. The movie is coding us towards a more glamorous image that, frankly, never was there in the first place.
And then it pulls it out from under us.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Oh, let me give a quick shout-out to Sharon Stone, by the way, who plays Linda's mother.
No kidding. Ah. The shock.
Wow, you almost don't recognize her. It's a great performance. She's definitely moving into the character actor phase of her career, and this could be a very good thing for her.
Even the body and the way the dress falls.
Oh, God, yeah, the way she walks. Yeah, everything. It's incredible.
I was one of those who had to find out at the credits that it was Sharon Stone, because I don't like to go to movies knowing any more than I have to.
Right.
Wow.
Well, I'm curious. I'm sure there are people out there are going to want to know, is there hardcore porn in this film?
It sidesteps those issues way too much, in my opinion. If you're going to make a movie about Deep Throat, I'm sorry. Go for it.
I guess they were going for an R.
Yeah.
They might have been afraid they'd get NC-17.
I could see some viewers looking at this movie and not quite sure what all the shouting's about, maybe. What do you think?
I don't know.
What are some of your favorite adaptations of actual events played back on the big screen? What makes the good ones work? Are there some memorable misses? Give us a call, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Since we're talking about contemporary events, I'd like to quickly cover a movie called Jobs, which is a biopic about the late Steve Jobs. And this is an interesting biopic that starts out with Jobs' time at college when he's trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life, you know, the barefoot hippie who always smelled bad and, you know, and people recognized his professors recognized his brilliance, but could never get him to focus on anything. And he wasn't sure what he wanted to do and experimenting with drugs and all of those kinds of things. It's a very well-produced and smart biography. Ashton Kutcher, I think, is remarkably good. I was taken aback because, you know, he's done light comedy and that's what he's known for. So when he had an opportunity to do this film, as someone who is highly interested in the tech world, as Ashton Kutcher is, that was very interesting. I think he acquits himself pretty well. The only problem with this film is that we never quite get beyond the surface. We get the events and we see that he's possessed in some ways, that he's, you know, he's always trying to push himself and others to excellence. But what his motives behind that are, we're never, ever quite sure. Plus, his personal life, with the exception of the line about him having an illegitimate daughter, there's nothing about his personal relationships. And that would be so telling to let us in on the person that Steve Jobs really was. So I have kind of mixed feelings about it. So overall, I'm going to give Jobs a 3 out of 5 stars, but respectable, well-made, but not compelling. When you have a forceful figure, a figure as forceful and compelling as Steve Jobs was, you need a forceful and compelling film, and this is not it.
Ashton Kutcher is proving himself to be a much more substantial public persona, I think, than we have been prepared for. I've been hearing some speeches that he's given in public venues to young people who I think are not hearing him at all. But he's...
You're sure about that, huh?
I'm afraid so. I have the hoots and jeers. But the message he's been delivering, the respect for work and things like that, has kind of surprised me. I have more respect for him, I think. Maybe I'm
He's a really
deluded.
Smart guy. If you watch interviews with him, he's actually a very, very smart guy. He just plays dumb characters really well.
That's Jobs, rated PG-13, and I'm giving that a 3 out of 5 stars. Let's completely change venues here just for a moment, and let's talk about something completely different. Here's a comedy that stars Kansas City's own local hometown hero, Jason Sudeikis. It's a really raunchy comedy called We're the Millers.
I loved it. I loved this film. I had so much fun watching it. I think they had a lot of fun doing it. It's the Griswolds once again on the road. It's a Lampoon Vacation kind of film when you think about it, although the family here is an assembly of disparate characters that are on the road in their RV. And they're running drugs from Mexico on up into the States. It's got everything in it that you can be offended by. Believe me. I mean, threesome sex. See, there's some things I think I might not even want to mention. But it is having so much fun being bad that I laughed my head off. And I don't do that very often anymore these days. Not sure why. But I liked it a lot. I totally recommend it if you go into it knowing that it is a bit of a raunch fest. But I had a great time with it. I'm going to give it 4.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't like it nearly as well as you did. I did laugh. I think probably the thing that most locals will want to know is obviously how's Jason Sudeikis, and he's quite good. Also, I don't know if you noticed, John, but in one scene he was wearing an Oklahoma Joe's barbecue t-shirt.
Right, and in another, that's gotten some play.
Yes. And another scene, he was wearing a Arthur Bryant's barbecue t-shirt. And when he was on Good Morning America, they carted out a whole bunch of ribs from Oklahoma nice. Joe's just so he'd feel right at home.
I want to mention the kid that plays the young son, Will Poulter. He plays a character named Kenny. He's a bored, naive teenager. He is an absolute lookalike, or should I have said the model, for Tintin.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
Exactly like him. And what he has to put up with, the indignities that he has to withstand in this film, are humbling, dismaying, and completely hilarious. So kudos to him. I'm also looking through, and hey, Aniston.
Wow.
Jennifer Aniston, striptease in the garage. Mm-hmm. Believe me, she does a lot with a pair of overalls.
Enough said.
She's having a good time in this film, too. I've actually heard some criticisms that she was kind of just going through the paces. I think her character, who's a stripper, is a remarkably understated one. I respect her for that. In fact, I happen to think she's a really fine actress. We've seen it in some movies in the past. Mm-hmm. So, good cast, too.
We're going to be taking a short break, but we want to make sure that you get in on the conversation at 816-235-2888. I'll have some announcements after the break, and we'll continue our conversation about current movies and about movies that are adaptations of actual events played back on the big screen. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined by John Tibbetts and Lloyd Lockerbie. We're talking about movies that have come out over the last month or so, and in particular, movies that are adaptations of actual events played back on the big screen. What makes the good ones work, and which are the ones that have dropped the ball? Let us know what you think. Join in conversation by calling 816-235-2888. Tweet us at KCURCST. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I do have a few quick announcements before we jump back into the conversation. I want to let people know that the National Theater Live series is continuing at the Tivoli. They've added additional performances of The Audience, which is the one that Helen Mirren stars in as Queen Elizabeth. There's going to be another screening of that on August 18th. As well as August 25th and September 8th. This is the one that was written by Peter Morgan, who wrote the film The Queen, and directed by Stephen Daldry of Billy Elliot and The Hours fame. But this is the National Theater Live presentation. That's at the Tivoli. And also the Tivoli will be showing Morrissey 25 Live. Morrissey, of course, the former lead singer for the Smiths, celebrating his 25th year as a solo artist. And this is a concert film filmed live at Hollywood High School. And that's going to be shown Thursday, August 29th at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli. More information available at kcur.org. And also, the Gather film series is continuing at the Glenwood Arts. These are never-before-seen independent films that are part of a regular series. And this Thursday, August 22nd at 7:30 at the Glenwood Arts at 95th and Metcalf, they'll be showing Savannah, a historical film starring Jim Caviezel, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Sam Shepard, and Hal Holbrook. It's a drama about a man who rejects the plantation life in post-Civil War South. And also, the off-the-wall film series continues. We talked a little bit about Jason Sudeikis earlier. There's another hometown hero named Paul Rudd, and they're showing his films. Dinner for Schmucks will be tonight, August 16th at 8:45 p.m. at the Downtown Central Public Library. And they'll be showing Wanderlust Friday, September 20th at 8:45, also at downtown. More information on all these events can be found at kcur.org. And, John, you wanted to add something as well?
Well, as most of us know, we are at the, I guess it's the 150th anniversary of Quantrill's infamous raid in Lawrence, Kansas, an estimated 200 people killed. Quantrill's force greatly approaching, I think, at least that number, coming in from Kansas City, and a dawn raid on the city. Well, there's been a lot of celebrations, if that's the word, memorial tributes, observances of that event. And part of that is something I'm going to do on Sunday at 2 o'clock. I'll be at the Helzberg Auditorium at the main library, and I'm going to talk about how the Quantrill raid has been interpreted and imaged in a number of films over the years. And believe it or not, I'm going to talk about one film where the raid never occurs at all. Quantrill and a handful of men ride up to the Lawrence outskirts and are turned away by the city, and that's it.
Wow.
And it's called Quantrill's Raiders. Well, there's no raid.
Hmm,
I mean, only in Hollywood.
Quantrill's
right.
Almost raiding.
But I'll also talk about Ang Lee's Ride with the Devil, which is a masterpiece, I think. So that's it. 2 o'clock, Healdsburg Auditorium, Sunday afternoon.
Thanks for that, John. That sounds really interesting. Let's bring in Lily into the conversation, who wants to talk about some of those contemporary films. Lily from Kansas City, welcome aboard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just saw the Lovelace movie last week with my husband, and we really enjoyed it. I think you already mentioned just the different perspectives that were, mm-hmm. the different shots, the first half and the second half. We just kind of thought the first half was, you know, like you said, showing all the glamour of the being famous in the porn industry and everything. But then the second half was the reality, and it was actually really upsetting. It was a date movie for us, so we thought maybe we should have picked a funnier film. But, yeah, it was very enlightening, and it made me think at the end of the movie that, you know, is this the story for many of the women in the porn and the adult industry, even now, just maybe not exactly the same, but maybe something similar to it. So it kind of was interesting in that aspect. And I thought it was very interesting that she said at the end she was in the porn industry for exactly 17 days, and it defined the rest of her life.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you think there's probably women who have been in it even shorter time than that, and it follows them forever.
Lily, I understand you have something you wanted to add about Steve Jobs as well.
Yes, I haven't seen the new film yet. But there's another film that is really good. It's called The Pirates of Silicon Valley, and it's about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and it's just kind of about the beginnings of both of their careers and their interactions with each other.
Yeah,
so
there's
you might find that one.
There's an interesting moment in the film where Ashton Kutcher calls Bill Gates, and it's a profanity-laced tirade where he's accusing him of stealing all of their technology. It's a pretty telling
right.
moment.
Hmm. Right. Well, you might find this one interesting, too. I'm going to see the new one probably this weekend, but it's an older film. I think it was filmed in maybe the 80s, and it's just their interaction, and it shows a little bit about Steve Jobs' personality and his, a little bit of his personal life, too.
Thank you so much. It's a great call, Lily. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
And let's bring in Julie from Tonganoxie, who wants to tell us about her favorite adaptation of a historical event. Hi, Julie.
Hello. At the risk of giving away my advanced age, let me please mention Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy and Frederick March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, about the monkey trial.
Yes, please, the Scopes monkey trial.
But I'll tell you.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Oh, please, I would love to hear all your people's opinion on, I don't know how to do this, but I'd love to make a writing campaign to Hollywood. We have got to have an Academy Award for casting, because casting is everything on these films. And I know the director is important. I know the cinematographer, the cutter, is important. But goodness me, the casting of Frederick March and Spencer Tracy in that film made the film. And so many films nowadays, I think the casting is everything.
I know the Screen Actors Guild does an ensemble award, which is kind of their best picture, but it gears a little bit towards that. But sometimes, you know, you can't pick out one individual great performance. You just have a really good ensemble.
I might add, though, as an adaptation, Inherit the Wind, both play and film, is a wholesale reinterpretation and rewriting of the Scopes trial.
True enough, but it's packs an emotional wallop. It's a very well done.
Don't use it as a history lesson, but use it for other reasons,
Could I just love it because it's a great film?
Absolutely. Thank you, Julie.
Great.
Says it all.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call. And you can join the conversation as well at 816-235-2888. Do you have a favorite adaptation you'd like to tell us about, or something else about movies handling current events? We're all ears, so go ahead and join the conversation. Now, let's change tracks just a little bit and talk about a science fiction film that was at the top of the box office last weekend. It stars Matt Damon, and it's called Elysium.
Well, you know, in a funny way, it does relate to real events
sure
in the
does.
Sense that it's very much a movie for the 99%. It's directed by Neil Blomkamp, who did the excellent District 9, which was also a very allegorical science fiction film. In this one, Earth is basically a giant favela. It's basically a huge pollution-choked slum where everyone lives in poverty, and the richest people live on this orbiting station called Elysium that's basically a paradise. But they protect their paradise very closely. And Matt Damon's character comes upon something that could, in fact, completely turn everything upside down if he can just get up there. And, it's an interesting setup because Blomkamp is very good at making it feel realistic. Even though it's science fiction, it's allegory, you can kind of see how things could go that way in the future. And that really is, if you're doing something like that, you have to try to ground it in some kind of reality, even if it's completely outrageous. The problem, though, is that the last third of it probably is just an action movie.
Yep.
It's like they kind of do away with all the interesting ideas, and it just turns into a big blow-things-up action flick, which is disappointing because it's heading in a good direction. And then just kind of, I don't know if Blomkamp felt pressure to make a big summer blockbuster kind of thing.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder what he would have done if he'd had a more of a District 9 budget, because that's a much tighter film and it holds together much better. Performance-wise, though, I mean, Matt Damon, carries it. Sharlto Copley, who was in District 9, is great as the villain. Jodie Foster has fun as another villain. It's an interesting idea, but I do kind of wish it had been another kind of lower budget film without the blockbuster pressure, because I think it would have been better. I'd give it a 3.
John?
Yeah, I agree with Loie. I think the suits stepped in, as they're called. The financiers stepped in at some point and said, look, we've got to be having Matt Damon kicking butt. Let's figure out a way he can do it and why and all of that. And to heck with the thematic materials introduced. The whole H.G. Wells, Morlocks, and the Alloy. And the heck with that. Well, that's a shame. And so much of what Blomkamp had done before is pretty much discarded here. May not be his fault, but again, there it is on the screen. I might add, without getting into details about the film's ending, that what we do have is a far worse chaos than anything that we've been introduced to in the film. And the film doesn't seem to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
At all. What a dumb, dim-witted movie this turns out to be. I'm going to go a 2.
Well, I liked it a little bit better. I think that you're right. It doesn't live up to the standards of District 9, and it does have its flaws. It's a little bit heavy-handed in the allegory about healthcare and the 99% and so on. But I still found it interesting. The biggest flaw, from my perspective, was Jodie Foster,
wasted.
Who plays the mustache-twirling villain. I mean, this villain is so obvious that I think she's so reliable that it has to be that it was. That's just the way it was written. That's the way it was directed. And you think, she. And what's the deal with her phony accent? I don't know what that's about either.
Yeah, why is she French for no reason? I don't get it.
But overall, I thought it was beautifully produced.
Good-looking film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's compelling. It will retain your interest. So I'm going to give it a 3. So I think we can, between the three of us, average it out to a 3 for Elysium, which is rated R.
All of the time that Los Angeles is in its turmoil, I kept wondering, what's the rest of the world doing?
Yeah.
When you take on a subject this big, I think you need to give us a little bit more of an overview of what's going on.
Yeah, there's no sense of history. There's mm-hmm. no sense of, okay, how did this happen? Why did this happen? How did we get here?
I would like to touch base and make sure that I get some info in about a movie that I think is the best film playing in Kansas City right now, and it's called The Hunt. This is Thomas Vinterberg's film. It's a Danish film that stars Mads Mikkelsen, who's probably best known as TV's Hannibal. Excellent actor.
And The Royal Affair.
Yes, that's right. He won the award at Cannes this year for his performance in The Hunt. And this is a nightmare. This is the cinematic nightmare. It's a story about a man who is a school teacher who is accused of sexual abuse by a small child.
Well, it sounds a little bit like Election, with Reese Witherspoon, although the victim, so-called, is younger here.
Yeah, it's what happens when fear, well, good intentions when fueled by fear can lead to really bad things in spite of everyone's good intention. And it makes this man's life hell, and he's innocent. And it's just heartbreaking, but it's so compelling and so interesting that I highly recommend it. As a matter of fact, I'm giving it a 4.5.
Wow.
And that is The Hunt, rated R.
You persuaded me.
Okay. Now, we want to bring in another quick call. I want to say hi to Cynthia from Overland Park. Welcome aboard, Cynthia.
Yes, good morning. The film Zero Dark Thirty was great. I don't know how historically accurate it is, but I just appreciated the character development. I get so tired of these movies where the theme and the writing is centered around the white guy is always right mentality. And with this, the woman carried the movie, but she was fanatical, you know, but she was also balanced by more conservative opinions, and also they did not throw in the obligatory romance.
Yes,
thank God.
Yes, give me a break, you know. In the middle of a desert, you don't think about that. But I just love it how they just provided that a woman, a person of character and strength and determination can succeed in spite of all odds, but it didn't make her alone. I mean, she wasn't her against the world. Like, I always have the male character saying, I am right, everyone else is wrong, therefore my tenacity continues. But I thought it was a well-balanced movie, and only time will tell how historically accurate that it was, but it was a well-done movie, deserving all of the awards.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and she's based on a real person, too.
Right.
Yeah, so that makes it even more interesting.
Why, in the past, what they normally would have done is given that character to a man to make it more palatable.
Yeah, so good on Catherine Bigelow. I'm glad she's out there.
Very good. Thank
you so much, Cynthia. So how much does accuracy matter? You know, we talked to the lady who earlier thought that, you know, Inherit the Wind was a great film, and I tend to agree with her. But if it's not historically accurate, is that bothersome as well? I mean, give us your opinions, 816-235-2888. I also wanted to touch on another film that deals with kind of contemporary issues. This is another documentary. It's called Blackfish, and this is the story about some recent events where trainers who work with orcas at venues like SeaWorld have had accidents and problems, and some of them fatal, when dealing with these giant, majestic creatures that are housed in these tiny pools, tiny relative to the size of these giant fish, and they spend their lives there. And it's really a very heartbreaking documentary. It shows, with talking heads as well as some graphic footage, how difficult it can be when you're dealing with these giant creatures, and how sometimes you could say that the powers that be in SeaWorld and so on are covering up these events just because they don't want the general public to think that they might be mistreating the animals. Now, of course, there are two sides to every story, and this story just gives the side of the trainers that have become disgruntled and those that are the animal advocates who thinks that this is a horrible way to treat these magnificent creatures. I tell you what, it makes its case. It makes a very strong case that perhaps these animals shouldn't be housed, and they should be allowed to live free in the ocean. But I will let everyone make that decision for themselves. But it's a powerful movie. It's rated PG-13, but it is disturbing. It's called Blackfish. And so that's a documentary that's currently playing. And John, quickly, I would like you to, this is also kind of ties in, 20 Feet from Stardom is a movie we didn't get a chance to chat about last time, and this is a documentary about backup singers.
Yeah, it was only on the recommendation of a good friend of mine that I went to see this at all. I am guilty of prejudging it because there was a time in my life when I had little interest in the whole Motown thing, the backup groups with the headliners and all of that. Just wasn't my thing, and still isn't in a way, but I'll tell you, seeing this film, it was an electrifying experience for me. These young black women, the singers, they might as well have been headliners. They are fantastic, and their stories, were they like the butlers in the White House, I wonder? Were they there not to be too obvious? But they are, because the film brings them back from the back ranks into the forestage, and there's a bunch of names that I really would not have known about otherwise. I'm going to talk about some of the people that we see on camera a lot that I'm sure the listeners will know far more than me. Charlotte Crossley, Lisa Fisher, Judith Hill, Mary Clayton, and especially a lady named Tata Vega. I did not know this person at all. And we also get testimonies from the likes of Sting and Mick Jagger and people like that talking about working with these groups and the injustices that faced many of them when they tried to assume a front rank stardom of their own. Is the word injustice there? It's a matter of public taste, public celebrity, I guess. As one of them says, you think you're on a springboard, but you're on quicksand. You think you're get ready for stardom, but actually what you're in is a quagmire, and you're never going to make it other than being in the back row, buttling in the kitchen, as it were, in the dining room. 20 Feet from Stardom is terrific, great singing. It's cleaning up. I understand that a lot of people now are regarding it as one of the best films of the year. And anytime you can see a film that's a discovery against or contrary to what you might have expected, I think that's really worth shouting about. And I'm giving it a 4.5,
okay.
20 Feet from Stardom.
Now, that sounds a bit like Standing in the Shadows of Motown, which is another documentary that came out a few years ago about the backup musicians for all of those Motown hits that never quite got the due that they deserved.
And if I could add just one more thing, a lot of the singing is full volume, full-throated, almost like a primal scream, but conditioned and controlled. But what I liked most about the movie was when these singers brought it down, sang a cappella, almost in a whisper, some of them. And there's one amazing sequence where the young black singer, the movie splits her into five selves, five different images on the screen, and they're singing what is a kind of a Baroque contrapuntal lick. Wow. So from a soft whisper to a full-throated scream, these singers are amazing.
Also, talk quickly, if you would, about another documentary that's causing some controversy called The Act of Killing. John,
well,
I know you saw that one.
I wish we could be talking about that the entire hour. It's one of the most amazing films I've seen in a while, maybe ever. Not that Indonesian gangsters and paramilitary groups in 1965 is a subject that comes readily to mind. Some of us might remember Peter Weir's The Year of Living Dangerously. But it was in that year that the government was overthrown by the military, and anybody accused of being a communist was killed, tortured. I mean, farmers, politicians, ethnic Chinese. It's been estimated that more than 1 million communists are killed, assisted by Western governments. Were they communists? Sometimes yes, sometimes not. So what? What happens in this film... why am I chuckling? Because it's so startling. You have a number of these thugs, these gangsters so-called, who appear on camera now, 40-some years later, reenacting for the camera the techniques that they used to torture their victims. Gee, beating them up is too bloody. Let's take a wire noose and strangle them to death. And better yet, let's demonstrate it. Somebody go sit in the chair there while I put this noose around your neck. Do I have second thoughts about it now, some years later? Well, if I do, I just have a hit of marijuana and go into a cha-cha.
Wow.
And so the guy goes into a cha-cha for the camera and everything is fine.
Wow.
And then these guys are so excited about remembering what they did that they want to make a movie of their own about what they did. So get this. Once influenced by American gangster films, now they are going to make a film of their own that will reflect what they did or what they think they did and are boasting about. And you have a scene where the family, including the kids, are watching the reenactments on the TV screen as they had been filmed. You think this is disturbing? Think this is dismaying? And yet what a comment on media and what a comment on a sociopathological mindset, dare I say, worldview. Yeah, the movie really, really blew my mind. Five stars
for The Act of Killing. I have to say I have mixed feelings about whether I want to see it. I do want to see it, and at the same time, I don't.
You have to see it.
Okay.
You have to see this film.
Let's bring Lisa from Merriam into the conversation. Welcome aboard, Lisa.
Hi.
You wanted to give us a couple of examples that you would recommend?
Yes, I was just going to recommend The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a really powerful adaptation of the memoir, and it really captures the power of memory and imagination.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And the ability of the film medium to convey all that.
Julian Fellow, who was the
Julian
director?
Julian Schnabel,
right, yeah. right.
Yes, and I am not a fan of him. I think he's an egomaniac, and I can't stand to hear him speak. And I was surprised at just how successful and how fantastic the film was, in spite of that. And I think it was very brave to try to adapt that memoir. It's very important to get it right. And he did make some disturbing changes to the facts, but ultimately I thought it still held up pretty well.
Hey, thank you so much, Lisa. It's a great recommendation.
Yeah, thanks.
You bet. Lori, let's quickly talk about a couple of other mainstream movies that came out. One is The Wolverine.
Yeah, The Wolverine is sort of the latest in the X-Men saga, a big improvement over X-Men Origins Wolverine. You know, Hugh Jackman returns. He's in Japan most of the time on this one. And, you know, it's much more, the action scenes are great, which is really all you want. You want a charismatic actor. You want it to keep moving. You want some good set pieces. It's got all that. It's not fantastic, but it's still pretty good summer blockbuster. So I'll give it a 3.5.
And John?
Very quickly, did you get weary of the fact that, well, I want to be immortal? No, I don't want to be immortal. I've got these claws in my hands. No, I don't have them. Yes, I want them. No, I don't. Give me a break.
Well, I don't think he's as ambivalent as everybody else is.
How many stars, John?
Oh, 2.
Okay, let's average it out to 3. I'm giving it a 3 for The Wolverine. And quickly, Planes, Loie.
Oh, boy, this is Pixar's first really bad stumble. It's kind of a quasi-spinoff of Cars, but it lacks the visual imagination. It lacks the great voice work. It moves quickly. It's got some nice animation, but it feels like one of those straight to DVD knockoffs. So that's it too.
And that's what it was. Yeah. I'm giving it a 3. So we'll say 2.5 for Planes, rated PG. It looks good, but it's pretty standard fare. And it's not Pixar. It is Disney. And there are reasons for that.
John Lasseter produced it.
He did.
Which is sad.
Yeah. Right.
Worst movie of the season?
Go ahead.
2 Guns.
Okay.
No.
I want to
is that bad?
Thanks to my fellow movie critics, John Tibbetts and Lori Lockerbie. I want to let you know that Central Standard will return on Tuesday for a conversation with religious scholars about the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth. Up to Date is next with the changing nature of fatherhood. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Thanks to Kim Noble, our announcer. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard, and enjoy your weekend.